Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're tuned in today. If you had an idyllic week of hiking and wildlife watching planned in a national park this summer, you might be discovering that the park you'd like to go to is either seriously crowded or closed. In mid-June, Arches National Park in Utah warned visitors that they had closed the gates at 8:30 a.m. because the park was so full. Consider returning a few hours later, the Twitter message said, or visiting other attractions. Yellowstone has seen an 11% hike in visitor numbers, and it was already crowded. And other parks are using a reservation system. Today, a conversation about how to find that solitude and serenity and those singular experiences that so many of us have had in a national park, and how to make the national park experience more available to more people without just intensifying the crowds. So that's what we're talking about this morning, really tapping into that serenity and that solitude and the reason that we go to a national park and making them more accessible, even though we don't want to end up in the park and find that we're surrounded by other people. So how do we do that? Our guests are with us this morning. I want to hear from you. Have you had an experience that really transcends all others for you in a national park? For me, it was one of the last trips I took with my dad, and we went to Death Valley, and I just found the landscape there, and he did too, really fascinating. So for you, was it seeing animals that you didn't expect to see? Was it camping with friends under the stars? Was it losing yourself in the majesty of the scenery? Talk to me this morning about that singular experience in a national park, I guess, or a state park. We have some pretty magnificent state parks around here. Or on Twitter, you could tweet it at me. You could tweet a photo if you've got one, or an experience that you've had. Our guest this morning, Jenny Anselmo Sarles, is the chief spokesperson at the National Park Service. Wow, she's with us from Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. Jenny, you are so lucky. Boy, that is a beautiful park. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Carrie.
It's really good to have you on the show. Ashley D'Antonio is an assistant professor of forest ecosystems and society at Oregon State University and a recreational ecologist. Ashley, how do I get a job like that? That sounds like a really good one. What do you do?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I am a scientific researcher, and I get to go to national parks and study the visitor use there and how the visitor use might impact the environment and how to balance those two things.
I gotcha. Okay, good. So you're perfect, both of you, for this conversation this morning. I want to take a call from Kathy in Eagan, who, boy, she's like right on what I want to hear from our listeners on. So Kathy, I'm so glad you called. Tell me about your experience.
Hi.
Hi.
We were in a state park, this was probably 20 years ago, with our kids and family, and we were hiking in the woods on a beautiful, sunny, clear day, no wind or anything. And as we're walking along, we heard some crackling off to the side of the path. And as we stood there, we watched a humongous tree just fall
wow.
in the forest.
Whoa.
Yeah.
A little bit of danger.
It was so amazing.
Yeah. The spice of danger, but also you probably felt like if a tree falls in the forest and no one sees it, I saw it.
Exactly.
How unusual is that, right?
Exactly. It was so cool.
That's really great. Thanks so much for the call. Much appreciated. Jenny, I want to talk to you a bit about the parks where the crowds are most intense. Is this about, hey, most of us didn't get out during the pandemic and we are all just going to love our parks? Or what's happening? Or has this been a trend that we're seeing building over the last few summers?
I think both, Carrie. This is a trend we've been seeing between 2009 and 2019. So over the last decade, some parks have seen a 40 to 60% increase in visitation.
Wow.
But we are expecting one of our busiest summers ever as more Americans are vaccinated and eager to travel and get out. So we're happy to welcome people back. We're asking you to plan ahead. Make sure that you have a reservation before you hop in the car, so those only surprises you have are happy ones.
So I mentioned that Arches in Utah at 8:30 in the morning had to close the gates because the park was so full. And I assume they were waiting for people to kind of get through it and then maybe they opened later in the day. How common of an experience is that going to be this summer? I mean, where are you likely to encounter that? Which parks? Because I want to talk about other parks that people ought to be going to.
Yeah, that's great. I think the most popular destination national parks are where you're going to see longer lines and high visitation. Arches is routinely filling in the mornings before 7:30 a.m. And that's really changing the way people are using the park. But it's those big popular destination parks, the ones that are most famous, like Yellowstone or Yosemite or Glacier or the parks in Utah.
Yeah. So, Ashley, here's the deal. It seems like all these experiences that I'm talking about, the solitude and the serenity, I think a lot of us are going to parks for that. And when you get there, you find that that is an almost impossible experience unless you get way out into the back country. So what's happening to the ecology of the parks as we crowd in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so we know that outdoor recreation can impact things like vegetation and wildlife. So we want to follow those principles of leave no trace. The field of recreation ecology is a pretty new field. And so we understand that some of these impacts are happening, but they're very site specific. So I'm unable to say, you know, this is happening at all parks, but outdoor recreation is not impact free. So we really want to be careful about following leave no trace principles, giving wildlife their distance, not trampling vegetation so that as visitors, we can minimize our impact while we're there and to make sure that we're not, you know, adding to those additional impacts.
Yeah, Ashley. So with the wildlife, I mean, that is one of the, you know, the really unique experiences I've had in national parks in Colorado and up in Montana, where you glimpse wildlife that you just you think of right in on television or that you never really expect to see out roaming free. But I wonder if when you've got just a constant parade of people and the noise that we bring with that and, you know, the sounds and the litter or whatever that we bring with that, what kind of an impact that has on animals?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on the type of species. So you go to national parks and you see wildlife, right? So we know we're not kind of scaring them all off into different locations, but it can result in wildlife being habituated. So they can, that means they're attracted to people. You know, you might have been somewhere where there might be a squirrel that really wants to get food from you. That's not a natural behavior. So that can be a type of impact we see. Other wildlife species might be more sensitive and therefore you might not see them when you're in the parks, right? So things that are more cryptic, and they can move into areas of the park where there's less visitor use. And so if we think about these national parks, they're very often, not all, but often are very large spaces.
Right.
So there can be areas where wildlife can kind of get a little bit of reprieve from those visitors. So it's very wildlife species and even individually dependent. So certain one animal might be really sensitive to visitors and another animal, the same species, might not be.
Okay, I'm going to talk about wolves in Yellowstone here in a bit, but I want to grab some calls to Erica in Minneapolis. Hi, Erica. What is your transformational experience or just something that is really special from a national park?
We had the wonderful opportunity to take race bikes for a youth triathlon team in North Minneapolis to California. And on the way there with Coach Smith, who's an elder in our community, and two young folks that had not really gone to a national park in the van with us, we landed in Zion National Park, and it was the most amazing experience to see it ourselves and then be with two young people. His grandson and my son were both team members as well. The rest of the team was flying. We were given this great gift to be on these tiny roads with this trailer full of race bikes that didn't belong to us around the edges of going through and above and around Zion.
Wow.
And I just will never forget the experience and the feeling that we all had and how the youth were seeing it too for the first time. It was so stunning and transformative. And then we got to the race with these bikes that had been loaned to us for the whole team that were going on, some of them on a plane for the first time to national triathlon competition. And the team was seeing the ocean for the first time when they got there.
Yeah.
And swimming in the ocean for the first time. And then they placed 11th through 2nd and took 1st as a team.
Oh, wow.
And from North Minneapolis.
Like, oh, my gosh. There's a lot of firsts there. Erica,
yeah,
wow.
It was just a stunning experience, thanks to the V3 team and families. But those 17 kids saw the ocean, and those two young folks that took the long haul with us.
I'm glad to have the call, Erica, and to share the experience. Thank you. Barb says, I had a profound spiritual experience in Yellowstone. About a mile off the usual paths, we encountered a geyser that had a rhythm that was exactly right for watchful meditation. Jenny, I want to ask you about Yellowstone. That's one of the very crowded parks, but there are some amazing things to see in Yellowstone. How do you have a singular experience in a park that is just a magnet for a lot of people? So how do you do it?
Well, the good news in Yellowstone is you have over 2.2 million acres to explore in the park. And by planning ahead, talking to a ranger, visiting the park website before you go, you can find those hidden gems, even in a really popular place like Yellowstone, where you can get off the beaten path. And if you plan ahead and can do it, getting even just a mile or two down a trail, you won't find as many people. There are incredible experiences to be had throughout Yellowstone and throughout other parks. One of my best tips is to go early in the morning or come late in the evening. Earlier than you might normally get up is when you're going to see the best wildlife, especially if you're looking for wolves or bears or some of the animals that tend to be out before dawn and after dusk.
So get into the park really early, get down the trail, try not to just make your experience about lingering at, some of the big sites. And
if you plan ahead, you can have some other options too. So you might get to that parking lot and it's already full at 8 a.m. So you have a backup plan and you find another trail that was plan B and you can get away from those crowds.
Cynthia says on Twitter, regarding crowds' impact on parks, talk about the inconvenience of getting to the most amazing spiritual Chaco Canyon. Is this on purpose? You really got to want to get there, especially with an RV. Where is Chaco Canyon? Do either of you know? Jenny? Ashley?
I'm embarrassed to say that I am blanking right now, and unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to get to myself, but there are a variety of experiences. Some parks are more easy to access. Others are off the beaten path.
Right.
And planning and knowing what to expect will really help ensure a great experience.
Jeff, our national park guru, is telling me it's in New Mexico. And Cynthia, I've just put it on the list. I want to go see it, even if it's a little difficult to get there. So it's a conversation this morning, if you've just gotten in, with Jenny Anselmo-Sarles from the National Park Service and Ashley D'Antonio of Forest Ecosystem Society at Oregon State and a recreational ecologist. We're talking about the singular experiences that you can have in national parks and how many Americans are looking for those experiences because the parks are crowded. Some of them, the big ones. We're also going to give you the names of some of the parks that don't get enough visitors that you should absolutely put on your list. So I want to hear from you this morning about an experience that is really transcendent in a national park. I mean, maybe it was seeing that wildlife that you didn't expect to see, having an encounter with a bear that was just far away enough. Was it camping with friends, with good girlfriends under the stars? Was it losing yourself in the majesty of the scenery? To Justin in Duluth. Hi, Justin. Good to have you on the phone. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to be here. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to say, your guest actually talked about what I was going to say about Yellowstone getting up early. But, when I think about that, one thing we did is we had a fourth grader with us, which was a terrific program, so we got into all the parks free 1 year.
Ah.
But we got up really, really early. We figured out right away it gets crowded right away, so get up super early. And we discovered that in Yellowstone's pretty high, so it's cold in the morning, often below freezing, even around the 4th of July we were there. And when you're in the caldera, you see things that you wouldn't see during the day because it's so cold. there's steam vents that you wouldn't normally see all over the place. Huh. And we went by one hillside where the whole hillside was steaming. And it brought it back home like, oh, this really is a big volcano. And I didn't never see it before because I'd always been there in the heat of the day and there's no, you don't have steam flowing out of the ground.
I love what you're thinking about here, Justin, because that's kind of the point of the show, Ashley, to, you know, take in the nuance and the grandeur of the landscape. And that's really hard to do when there's a lot of other people around, right? You just kind of lose that experience. Tell me a little bit about an experience like that that you've had in some national parks. Ashley, I was thinking about you for that. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're thinking about me for that one? Yeah, go ahead. I can hear you. So experiences that I've had in national parks?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so I think one of my most memorable experience in a national park was actually Isle Royale National Park, which is in Lake Superior. And in that park, you know, it can be kind of crowded close to the areas where folks access and get off the boats, but it's a great place for getting into the backcountry. And one of our nights camping, we saw a pair of wolves chasing a moose into some water on Isle Royale. So it was a really amazing wildlife experience. And we were able to find that solitude once we got a little bit into the backcountry there.
Wow. So, you know, I've never been to Isle Royale. How did you choose it? You live in Oregon.
At the time I was actually living in Wisconsin. I was a middle school and high school teacher for a couple years. And so I chose it as it's a harder to get to park. And so I figured since I was living in Wisconsin, that was one of the easier ways to access it from there. So you do have to take a boat. The Park Service does have a boat that accesses Isle Royale, and there's other boats that you can take in. You can take personal boats, but it is a little harder to get to, which I think makes it it's still, you know, a very popular park, but not as popular as some of these other places that we've talked about, like Yellowstone and Arches. So it's definitely one of my favorites, but a little harder to access.
Yeah, we're wolf people up here, so I assume that there's a number of listeners who have been to Isle Royale and had that experience. If you have, maybe you have a photo, tweet it to me. I'd love to see it. Annabelle says, after getting lost on deeply rutted roads in a Prius, we arrived at an unpeopled Chaco Canyon just at the golden hour. Enchanting. Oh, man, I really want to see this. On Top of the World from Bennett in Glacier National Park, our favorite national park. Okay, I'm going to retweet that beautiful photo. Okay, to Glenn in Northfield. Hi, Glenn. Thanks so much for waiting. Good to have you on the phone.
Yes, thank you much. We had the fortunate time to live in Montana for a while, but we left when one of my sons was two. So when he was 16, I decided to take him back for his real experience of Montana. And we were in Glacier Park. We were hiking midday, and I had lived in the mountains for several years, so I knew the weather patterns and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it was midday. We were some of the last people on this trail up to a glacier, and we got to this real narrow spot where we were coming around a bend. And we were standing there admiring a lake, and I looked up the trail, and about 20 yards from us was a grizzly bear. And he was doing the same thing we were doing, but waiting for us to move, and because we couldn't go right or left. So my son's got his camera out on his phone, and he's taking pictures like crazy. He knows the seriousness of it.
Yeah.
But I start talking loudly, and I say, we're going to move back here now and get up that shale as far as we can get. No fast movements. We're going to keep talking, and then we're going to take a seat. And so we did, and the bear seemed satisfied. He got a little bit closer to us. He had to pass.
Wow.
And he kept glancing at us and went on his way.
Jeez. You know, I don't know that I would have been so calm, Glenn. When I hiked in Glacier with a friend, she wanted us to carry a bear bell or some bear spray or something like that. Jenny,
right.
If you're close enough to spray a bear, are you too close?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, that's what I thought.
But have bear spray. Know how to use it. Bear spray is incredibly effective at keeping people safe. If you do encounter a bear, make noise, get tall, stand your ground. And if you have the unfortunate experience, which is incredibly rare, of a bear actually contacting you, that's when it's time to play dead. The worst thing you can do is run away from that bear, even if you think your companions are slower than you.
Not even trying to climb a tree, nothing like that. If you are too close, lay down and pretend that you're dead.
If that bear touches you, otherwise make noise, get tall, and try and get that bear to run away from you. Bears are more afraid of you than you are of them. You are most likely to encounter a bear if you surprise them. And so when you're out hiking in a park, make lots of noise, talk to your friends, even if you're there to enjoy the solitude. Holler, clap your hands, hey bear, hey bear. That's the best way not to surprise a bear.
Oh. Ashley, I want to ask you about something here that I follow the writing of David Troyer. He's a Native American who was born here in Minnesota. I think he writes and teaches in California. But he had this really interesting article in The Atlantic in April that argues for returning the land of the national parks to the tribes from which they were taken. And here's a paragraph from this piece. I really recommend reading the piece, but here's a short graph from it. The national parks are sometimes called America's best idea, and there is much to recommend them. They're indeed awesome places, worthy of reverence and preservation, as Native Americans like me would be the first to tell you. But all of them were founded on land that was once ours, and many were created only after we were removed forcibly, sometimes by an invading army, and other times following a treaty we'd signed under duress. I don't think David Troyer thinks that's going to happen anytime soon, but I wonder if there is discussion about the idea of this in ecological circles.
Yeah, that is a really great question. And part of my job, in addition to being a scientist, I teach recreation management and visitor use and recreation ecology. And we are definitely having these discussions in academic circles about making sure at least that our students who are future recreation managements are aware of the history of the national parks and how they were created. And not only just looking at them as with these rosy colored glasses as these great things, which they are, but the way that they were created was by forcibly removing indigenous peoples from these lands. And so the conversations we're having is, you know, how do we tell that story? How do we make sure people are aware? How do we move towards more equity and inclusion with indigenous peoples in management and access to these landscapes? And so these are ongoing conversations that we're having in the academic realm and that I make sure my students are aware of. And I agree, that was a great piece out of The Atlantic.
I'm glad you caught it. You know, Jenny, in Minnesota, this is something that's really familiar to us. We've renamed lakes. We're aware that we're on Dakota land and other native land. What's the discussion within the Park Service about whether, even if it is not giving back all of the land, some kind of acknowledgement, as Ashley is suggesting?
I think the conversation that Ashley articulated is the same one we're having, recognizing the important history here, what makes these places special, but also a continual quest to do better and honor the people who are here before us. And so those are conversations we look at. The National Park Service and the Department of the Interior are committed to looking for opportunities to tell those lesser known stories, for meaningful engagement with tribes and indigenous people, and in ensuring that we are creating a place where people feel welcome and can have really positive experiences in parks, and that we're telling a fuller story and a fuller picture of American history. You know, we're talking today about the natural wonders of the national park system, but there are over 400 parks across the country, and many of those are places that honor or commemorate history and some of our most difficult moments as a nation. And that's something that the Park Service is privileged to do, too, as the steward of our shared cultural history.
Good point. I've been to Gettysburg. That's a national park, right? I think somebody tweeted about Valley Forge. Good thing to remind us of, Jenny. It sounds like you're saying the tribes are in on these discussions.
That's right. And that's something we want to continue to do more of and ensure that Indigenous people have a meaningful and substantive voice at the table as we make decisions about these places that belong to them.
Let me take a call here from Valerie in Farmington. Is this another bear story, Valerie?
This is.
All right.
another bear story at Glacier National Park.
Tell me.
So I'm a classical singer, which came in handy in this bear encounter. I was hiking along the Cracker Lake Trail, which is a beautiful glacial lake. And all of a sudden, coming back from the lake, I hit a bottleneck of other hikers with my friends. And we realized less than 50 feet ahead of us is a young bear on the trail.
Oh, boy.
So now we all start clapping and shouting and doing all the things we're supposed to do. And the bear just turned around and looked at us, but didn't move. And so at that point, I thought, well, I have to make the loudest noise I possibly can. And so I started singing Gustav Mahler at the top of my lungs.
My gosh.
I have to say, my friends, of course, knew that I was a classical singer, but all the other hikers didn't. So I think they were about as surprised as the bear was.
What'd the bear do?
He moved. He got off the trail. So we kept on walking back, and as I stopped singing, the bear plopped back on the trail. And so all of us, now hiking as a group, started making up our own lyrics, and we kept on singing new things to The Lion Sleeps Tonight. We made it 4 miles back to the trailhead, and every time we stopped singing, that bear would pop up either before us or behind us on the trail. So we just knew we had to keep on making noise.
Valerie, I am so glad you were listening today. I don't know if we can top that story, but I'm really glad you called. Thanks so much. Tuned in, just getting into the show today, we're talking about some singular experiences in national parks. Oh, and encounters with grizzlies where you sang to get them off the trail. Tell me a little bit about one of those experiences that you've had in a national or, you know, one of the big state parks and what makes it so unique. And on the other side of news, I'm going to give you a list, and so are Jenny and Ashley, a list of some other parks that are not as crowded as some of the big ones that you should absolutely put on your list. Okay, I've been polling people up here in the studio, Jenny and Ashley, for their favorite parks, but I want to hear yours first. Jenny, can you possibly choose among all of the parks? The ones you, maybe one that doesn't get visited that you really love. Yeah.
Of course not. Every park has something special. And
okay.
Something
everyone
in a park. But I did grow up just outside Grand Teton, and so it does hold a special place in my heart.
Mm, boy, it is beautiful. And it's now that's not one that I think has the kind of crush that some of the others have. Is that true, Jenny, or no?
Actually, it does.
It does.
You know, hotel reservations and campground reservations in Grand Teton and many of those other popular destination parks are fully booked or nearly fully booked through Labor Day. And, you know, the town surrounding the park is also experiencing this high visitation people coming to places like Grand Teton and Yellowstone.
Okay. Ashley, I'm going to throw out a couple of parks, and I wonder if you're familiar with them. Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park in Colorado. I've been there. Incredible. Yeah.
I know the name, but I've never been there, so maybe I should add it to my list.
Oh my gosh, spectacular canyon, beautiful forest. Jeff Jones, our friend in the engineering room here, says Assateague Island, Maryland, where wild horses run free. Ashley, do you know that one?
I do. I actually grew up on the East Coast, so I do know that, and that is a very, really amazing and unique park.
I am definitely putting that on the list. Easy to get to? Crowded? What should I know about it?
It's been quite a while since I've been there. It's a little out of the way, but I don't think it's as crowded as some other locations, and seeing the horses there is just incredible, and it's probably worth any little bit of crowding you might experience.
And off season, right? Why not? Mm-hmm. Yeah. To Maria in Hopkins, Minnesota. Hi, Maria. Thanks for waiting for the news through the news break. What's your story?
My pleasure. Thanks. Great show. My story is we took our kids pretty routinely to the national parks. And one of our favorite, I think kind of a hidden gem, is Capitol Reef National Park. And that's in South Central Utah. And it's in Red Rock country, but it has a fertile valley. And so I'm online trying to make sure I can provide accurate information, but Latter Day Saint pioneers planted thousands of fruit trees. So they're these orchards and you can go in and they give you pickers and you can pick fresh fruit. And it was Those are the best peaches I've ever had in my life. It's really an amazing hidden little gem.
So it's kind of this oasis where Mormon settlers planted orchards, and it survives to today. Wow.
It's a historic orchard. I think they're doing some maybe renovation now, but you can go and you can pick the apples, apricots, cherries, peaches, pears, plums. It's just amazing.
Geez, that's really neat. To Caitlin in Rochester. Hi, Caitlin. What's your story?
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I just love this topic so much.
I'm glad.
So this was now 12 years ago. It feels like just yesterday. I had the opportunity to spend this amazing summer as a camp counselor outside of Glacier National Park. And I had a bunch of extended family members
mm-hmm.
come out for a family reunion, and many of which had never really been camping, let alone backpacking. And I led a group of my cousins on a backpack to Crocker Lake.
Uh-huh.
Which was about 5 miles each way, which didn't really sound like that big of a deal to me at the time. But now in hindsight, when we got in, I was like, okay, so nobody's really backpacked before, and we've got to make it 5 miles in. So it was really cool to, share this experience with a bunch of city folks that would not have been on their agenda, but they were great sports and they learned about Leave No Trace, and we forgot the spoons for our tortilla soup. So we were all drinking out of these vessels. And then it started crazy raining. So a bunch of the boys were like, we don't need tents. But then there's four of them sleeping in a 2-person tent. And then we were hiking back and, the rain was just and then my cousin got a bloody nose and we ran out of toilet paper. So she had to use a tampon. I mean, just great experiences for everybody. And just the ability to share that and have them even 12 years later, just talk about that was one of the best family vacations ever.
You know, Caitlin,
this
sounds like it has gone down in family lore, right? This is the one of the legends of the family when you guys get together for a reunion and you talk about this. And that's special. I mean, that's really what that kind of travel is all about. It's really good to have your call. I'm going to mention a couple of other parks here that that are not as, not as well loved. Let's just say that by lots of crowds. Ashley mentioned Isle Royale in Michigan, Kings Canyon National Park in California. Ashley, are you familiar with that one since that's fairly close to you?
Yeah, I haven't been there, but I'm familiar with it. And it's also on my list of places to go.
Okay, good. North Cascades National Park in Washington State near the Canadian border. That's a place I really want to see soon. Jenny, where else? Are there some other parks that just don't get the attention that they really deserve?
Yeah, I mean, I think places like Lassen Volcanic in California or Devil's Post Pile in California.
Okay.
But if you're looking for thermal features and you couldn't snag that reservation in Yellowstone, I'd encourage you to check out Lassen Volcanic. You already mentioned Black Canyon of the Gunnison is a great alternative to Grand Canyon National Park. And out east, a place like Cumberland Gap in Tennessee
mm-hmm.
is a great place to go if you thought about Great Smoky Mountains, but that might be a little bit more crowded than the experience you're looking for.
Okay, good. To the phones to Paul in Oregon. Hi, Paul.
Hi, this is Paul in Oregon.
I'm glad you called. What are you recommending to us?
Well, I travel through Alaska every year for the last 40 years. I visit Denali National Park. And in Denali National Park in the last 40 years, we've had a reduction in the wildlife sightings on the 90-mile road with wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the goals in the national park is to preserve the wildlife, and they try to preserve caribou. We have 2,000, and maybe all sheep, we have over 2,000. They try to preserve the wildlife year to year, but We used to have over 20,000 doll sheep in Denali Park and over 20,000 caribou. And in the last 100 years, Park Service has never been able to restore the wildlife to the original numbers.
Hmm, okay.
So, for example, I traveled the road in Denali Park. I used to see an average of 7 grizzly bear on a day that I traveled a 90-mile road. But today in 2020, I can travel a 90-mile road and not see a single grizzly bear.
Well, let's ask so Paul, let's. I think we've gotten the essence of the issue here. Let me ask Jenny and Ashley about what might be going on there. Jenny, what about are wildlife flourishing in the park the way they used to, and what are some of the plans to bring more back in?
Yeah, no, I don't have any data or specific examples or evidence of decreases in wildlife in Alaska. So unfortunately, I don't have much on that for you, but there are many millions of acres and many unique experiences that you can have in Alaska, and a wide range of wildlife. Of course, Katmai has the famous bears. People probably follow along for Fat Bear Week as bears are preparing to go into hibernation in the fall. So you can still have some pretty incredible wildlife experiences in Alaska.
Ashley, what about the wildlife ecology? What do you know about it?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we're talking about Alaska, just one thing that came to my mind is, you know, in terms of wildlife settings along the road, the wildlife over time could be moving away or moving outside the park, right? These are large landscapes that are often connected to other protected areas too. So just because wildlife are decreasing within a park doesn't mean the population in that area is necessarily decreasing. Another thing that comes to mind, and I don't have hard data on this, but those species could be incredibly sensitive to climate change impacts as well. So it could be a combination of various pressures or impacts on those species if we are seeing a decrease. And, you know, I'd have to look at specific studies or information from that area to give a clear answer. But those are just some things I was thinking about as I was listening to the caller's story.
All right. Let me go to Sarah in Roseville. Sounds like we're back up in Glacier National Park, Sarah. Is that right? With the bears?
Oh, yeah, we're back in the Glacier. I wanted to mention Olympic Peninsula National Park, too. That's one of the best
good.
Places that you can go to.
Good.
But in Glacier, we saw a mountain lion. So we typically take the kids to the national parks because we had 4 and it's cheaper to drive to them all. We've been to Glacier 8 times. We do carry the bear spray, like they mentioned, and seen them up close once. But one night we were in our minivan because going to the Sun Road had been blocked off at night. And we were having to drive back. All of us were all looking out at the road, and a big mountain lion jumped right across the road in front of us.
Whoa.
And we all saw it.
And you were safely in your vehicle.
Yes.
And that's great.
They do say, though, at the campgrounds, the rangers had come up to us and said to keep the kids close, that some of the campgrounds, the mountain lion actually can be there, too. So,
okay. So now that we've mentioned kids, Jenny, I think I ought to ask you how you know, if a family is just not equipped for a camping trip, can get expensive buying the equipment. Maybe you don't have much experience, you know, with this kind of camping or exploration. How do you introduce the national parks to kids and kids to national parks in a way that really builds that conservation muscle? I'm sure you think about this a lot.
We do. And national parks are closer than you think. There's a national park in every state in the country. And even if it's not a national park, there are Fish and Wildlife Service refuges, state parks, county parks, where you can have those experiences, sort of your foray or entry into conservation or into outdoor experiences. There are many organizations in and around some parks that provide rentals for camping gear if you're not ready to make that investment or it's something you might just do once as a more affordable alternative. And national parks are still one of the best deals and most affordable experiences for families because you can get in for one fee for a group of 5, and that's going to be a lot lower of a cost than many of the other entertainment type venues you might experience on a vacation.
Ashley, I think one of the things that we've talked about before and that I think we ought to discuss this hour is, you know, the national parks are wonderful and we'd love to think of them as a democratic small D experience. But there are a lot of people that never really feel like that's the experience for them, or welcome, or have the money. What I'd love to hear what the discussion is about making national parks much more accessible to a number of Americans who just often don't think that that's their space.
Yeah, this is a really important topic. And another thing that we've been discussing a lot in the academic realm is how do we make national parks and outdoor recreation actually in general more right. welcoming and inclusive. And I think part of that is, you know, maybe, you know, Jenny's mentioning a lot of other places we can visit, state parks and local areas, kind of broadening the definition of what outdoor recreation is. It doesn't have to be this epic backpacking trip in a national park. That's great. That's a wonderful thing. But it can also be walking in your local park or your county park or visiting your state park. Also ensuring that the folks that are working in these places reflect the diversity of the United States and trying to diversify the staff and the workforce that are in our national parks so that when someone who may feel like they've been traditionally underserved by these places do visit, they see someone that looks like them and they do feel welcomed. So I think that can be an aspect of it as well.
Really good point there with the rangers and the staff. Jenny, do you know what the percentage is of rangers and staffers at the Park Service that are not white?
We don't have good data, but certainly it's no secret, and it is a challenge that we're trying to address because the vast majority of employees across the park system do tend to be white. And that is something we want to change because, as Ashley said, we think it's really important for the people who work in parks to reflect the people of our country and to make sure that people see themselves in national parks. We're working with a number of park partners across the country, with nonprofit organizations, and also providing those introductory experiences for people who may not automatically see themselves in a park, to introduce parks to them, to introduce national park careers through youth programs and internships in the park system.
So when you say that you are working with different partners, give me a sense of how who you're linking up with and how that might diversify the Park Service staff and rangers.
A variety of nonprofits that we work with provide support and recruitment for youth programs so that we can bring in youth from either traditionally underserved communities or minority communities or people who may not have found careers in the Park Service. So we're able to leverage those partnerships across the country to help bring more people into the system. We work with a broad coalition of stakeholders to reach new and different audiences. And the good news is we have started to see some change following the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, but mm-hmm. we still have more work to do. And that is something that we are investing in and that we are committed to, because parks belong to the American people. The Park Service, we care for these places. We are the stewards, but these places belong to all of you as Americans. And so it's important that you feel welcome and that our staff reflect the American people.
So, Ashley, I guess I would ask whether you think the Park Service is moving decisively enough on this, quickly enough.
I do think so. I mean, I'm seeing these conversations happening. I think partnerships, as Jenny mentioned, are really important because there are great organizations, nonprofits that are doing this work. And so partnering with them can really help to not only make sure you're moving in the right direction, but to hopefully also amplify the work that those nonprofits and organizations are doing to get folks in the outdoors. And so I do think the Park Service is going in the right direction. And some of these issues are systemic to society, and so the Park Service alone cannot kind of solve this diversity, equity, inclusion, and outdoor recreation issue. It's something we kind of all have to kind of work towards.
Jason called from Delano to say, my family and I went up to Voyageurs for a houseboat trip a couple of weeks ago. Boy, that sounds great. It was absolutely beautiful. The rocky cliffs, the nature right up to the side of your boat. I can't stop looking at the photos. I can't wait to go back. Hey, Jason, I'd love it if you'd tweet me a photo from the houseboat. What a great experience. Okay, and Ginger says, we just got back from Frog Bay, the first indigenous national park. Beautiful piece of country. Nick has sent me, and I've retweeted, a photo of our then 5-year-old in Volcanoes National Park. It was a little rainy and misty. Wow, so we got this amazing rainbow. Okay, to Shannon in Hopkins. Hi, Shannon. I'm glad you're calling with an experience. Fill me in.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am originally from northern Wisconsin and grew up on Lake Superior. No big deal to me living on Lake Superior, but when I turned 30, I decided I needed to push myself and take a great adventure. So me and some friends got together with some good friends who are experienced kayakers, and we actually ferried out to Stockton Island on the Apostle Island and camped. Campground right on the edge of the water. Gorgeous. And then we did some day trips to different islands. And I distinctly remember being really tired, being really scared, because Lake Superior is a lake that you really need to respect.
Yes.
And we arrived at our island, stopped, ate our lunch. And I just remember laying there on the beach, and it was gorgeous. It was clear. The lake was calm. And I lean over and pick some wild blueberries to eat. And I just thought to myself, this is the life. This is why I live near the beautiful Lake Superior.
Wow.
And I learned to really respect the lake, because it can be really dangerous, but it can be really beautiful.
Jeez, I love the call, Shannon. I'm so glad you heard the show and had a chance to call in. I think I can squeeze Maddie in Minneapolis in here. Hi, Maddie. What's your story?
Hi, I just wanted to give a shout out to the national parks. I went out with two of my girlfriends and to give us a venue to learn women had a place in these parks. And we got to learn a lot of skills that we hadn't been taught by other people, a lot of outdoor skills, and we continued to kind of practice those. So I think kind of exactly what you were talking about, that it's a place for everybody, regardless of what you look like or your gender. So I think it's really important to have these places for everybody and anybody.
I love the idea, Maddie, that you're out there with two friends and you guys are learning to be independent young women. Thanks for the call. Jenny, Ashley, thank you so much. Really good to have you on the show. And thanks to everyone who called with terrific recommendations. Jenny Ann Zamel-Sars is the chief spokesperson at the National Park Service. She's hanging out at Grand Teton National Park. And Ashley D'Antonio is an assistant professor of forest ecosystems at Oregon State, where she is also a recreational ecologist. Just a reminder again of some of the parks that came up. Assateague in Maryland. I love Death Valley. Really interesting landscape. Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park in Colorado. Kings Canyon National Park in California. Lassen Volcanic. The list goes on. If you missed them, you can listen on the podcast.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. You can hear the show live at 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News or by subscribing to the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. Thanks for listening.